Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio here in the Lehigh Valley. I'm John Pierce, your host, along with Seamus today. Seamus, thanks for coming in and helping.
Absolutely.
And we have a very interesting topic for you history buffs out there. It's the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And I wonder if that opening music has anything to do with what we're talking about today, Peter. Peter Osborne is our guest, and he's someone who has studied much about history, and including the Lewis and Clark Expedition. What's Shenandoah telling us?
Well, this particular CD is from a person who reenacts Pierre Croisset, who was one of the people on the expedition and was the only fiddle player. And so he was entertainment on a lot of the evenings during the course of the expedition. And so this music are all songs that were in that time period.
At that time period. Yeah. And the time period is?
1803 to 1806.
Mm-hmm. And we will get into talking about the Lewis and Clark Expedition in just a couple of minutes. First of all, Peter Osborne has a bachelor's degree from Rutgers. He was the executive director of the Minisink Valley Historical Society for about 30 years.
It was, yes.
Almost. And curator of education and special events at Red Mill Museum Village from 2010 to 2011 for a year. He is an historian and an author. And Peter, we are delighted to have you here at WDIY to talk to us about the Lewis and Clark Expedition.
Nice to be here.
So let's go on an expedition today. Seamus, I heard Peter give a talk at the Siegel Museum in Easton recently, and that's what made me want to bring him on as a guest today. It's really an interesting topic, and he's an interesting fellow to talk about it, too. So, Peter, when you were at Rutgers, did you major in history?
I did, American history. And my specialty was the Great Depression. And I'd gone to Rutgers to be a forest ranger. And first day, first class, first hour, first lecture, I had this fabulous history professor named Elliot Rosen, who had been involved with the one of the people that were one of the brain trusters of FDR's cabinet, kitchen cabinet. And had him and said, I don't want to be a forest ranger anymore. I want to be a historian.
The very first semester.
Yeah, yeah. And so I became a historian and have been a historian, public historian ever since, yeah.
Real interesting. So you were interested in the Great Depression. So mm-hmm. FDR is one of mm-hmm. your big interests.
Yes.
As well as Teddy Roosevelt.
I just spoke about him last week here in the Valley. But FDR was my interest, and since I couldn't be a forest ranger, I specialize in the CCC, or the Civilian Conservation Corps, and have written four books about that. So I kind of still have my hand in FDR, still have my hand in forestry issues and conservation issues, and Teddy Roosevelt, of course, set the standard for everybody after him with the conservation movement, as he was known as the conservation president.
Right. So. And when we go to the Lewis and Clark Expedition, we're going 100 years before Teddy Roosevelt.
Yep. Although he was a great fan. Teddy Roosevelt was a great fan of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, very knowledgeable about it. And in fact, in the centennial celebrations of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, he was then the president and dedicated a very large memorial out there in Portland, Oregon. So, and he was there at the Lewis and Clark Exposition as well.
It doesn't surprise us that he would be interested in the exploration of the West, right?
Yes.
What got you interested first in the Lewis and Clark Expedition?
Well, I've had an interest in it informally, I guess, since I was a kid. I remember those old Frederick Remington paintings that he did of the expedition. My family is from Montana. My mother's from Helena and Montana, which is the state capital. And, of course, in Montana, Lewis and Clark is serious business. So this is not for the faint of heart. You have to know what you're talking about if you're going to talk about Lewis and Clark in Montana. And then, I guess, since then, I've also was a great fan of Stephen Ambrose, who wrote really one of the best books that there was on the expedition, on his book about Undaunted Courage, as it was called. And his family continues to maintain an interest. His daughter has written books. They are out there in Helena still doing tours and Rhodes Scholar programs and that sort of thing. So I have, so that's how I kind of came to it. And it's a piece of history that I thought before I got very involved in it, that it was settled history, that I would not find a lot of controversy, or that everything was pretty much had been written about that could be written about it. But as I've since found out, that's not the case. And there's still a lot of debate going on about lots of aspects of the expedition. So,
interesting. I heard a teacher of English one time, and this was in another country, say, and I asked her if she had done her dissertation on Shakespeare. And she said, oh, no, they won't let you do that as a graduate student. It's already all been done, which, of course, is not true.
Right.
But for those who are just beginning their careers, yeah. Maybe a different.
And I should have known better, too, because I've written books about topics that have not been written about before. So I should have known better. But you would think that after so many years and after so much scholarly work has been done in this, that it would pretty much be settled. But it's really not. So
I agree. The farther away we get from the events, mm-hmm. the more we feel as if everything's been said about that.
Yep.
Now, you not only have written about Lewis and Clark, but you followed their trail in an RV named Miss Wolf Creek. My goodness, what an adventurer you are. And you have given us as a title for this interview,
Lewis and Clark and Me.
Right? And the reason is that you went out and you saw the trail,
yep.
much of it, of what they went mm-hmm. through in 1803, 1806.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about, how about this RV? Why is it named Miss Wolf Creek? When did you do this?
The trip was in 2008. And my wife and I bought a RV a year before that, or 2 years before that.
Wait a minute. You convinced her to go on this trip with you?
No, she had passed away. So that's what actually got me onto the trip. But we had bought this RV a few years before that. And because my family is from Montana, I'm a great fan of the book A River Runs Through It by Norman MacLean. And if you remember in the movie, there is a Miss Wolf Creek who is the woman, the prostitute that goes out with the brother of the author's wife and or wife-to-be. And so we thought it appropriate that we named our RV after that prostitute. So
sense of humor. So this was in 2008
yep.
that you made this trip. You took a sabbatical from your job. What was your job at the time?
At the time, I was a director of the Minisink Valley Historical Society in Port Jervis, which was a very full-time job. And after Janice passed, I decided to take a sabbatical of 3 months and to follow the route of Lewis and Clark. And it was one of those, it's a once-in-a-lifetime type of trip anyway. But I think when you have a catastrophic event like that happen in your life, I think that you sometimes need to stop and take, pause, and which is what I did. So I took 3 months off and traveled by myself from Port Jervis, New York, to Washington, D.C., to Pittsburgh, out to the Mississippi, up the Missouri, all the way across the Rockies, out to the Pacific, and then back. So.
Well, it sounds like such an easy trip when you say it like that in a matter of 10 seconds. Not so, right?
No, it isn't. And, I had thought originally about camping the whole way out, but I'd also decided I wanted to write a book about it. And so I was just before I was getting ready to leave, I had made two budgets, one to camp and one to do an RV. And believe it or not, you figure you're going to have to stop, and even if you're camping, stay in a hotel once or twice a week, take a shower, all that. Just get out of the environment a little bit. And I was talking to my lawyer a couple of days before I left, and he said, now, here you are. You're sitting in a tent, it's pouring rain, you're writing this book, and this drip of water hits your computer, and it's gone. Now, think about that, or when you're in your RV, and you're the rain and whatever is going on, you don't have to worry about any of it. And as it turned out, during the course of the trip, I was camped next to a couple people who had exactly that same thing happen to them. So I was glad that I had taken my RV. So, but we traveled the route or paralleled the route. I mean, you can't do the route really without being on the rivers, but we paralleled the route where possible and probably did about 70% of the route, I would say.
Right. Explain to us a little bit in the time of Lewis and Clark, and this expedition took place early 19th century. How much of their trip was over land and how much was on water?
I would say that the vast majority of it was on water. I mean, you're coming down the Ohio River from Pittsburgh to the junction with the Mississippi, up the Mississippi, up the Missouri. Once you get to the very end of the Missouri, which is on the Continental Divide between Idaho and Montana, then you're going over the mountains there. And then from there, you get onto the Snake and Clearwater Rivers, onto the Columbia, and then out to the Pacific. So it was probably 90% of it was on water. But parts of it, you had to portage, at Great Falls, Montana. They had no other way to get around the Great Falls except to portage, so they had to portage that area.
And so in those days, it would have been easier to travel by water than by land.
Yes, and they were carrying... What most people don't realize is, A, that this was a military expedition. It was not just 30 guys out there camping for the summer or whatever. That's one thing. And the other thing is that they brought enough equipment with them to be able to trade with the native peoples, to have enough weaponry to get back out there, to have enough paper to write their journals on, have enough food for an extended period of time. So they were carrying, when they left St. Louis, about 65,000 pounds of equipment in their keelboat. And then even as late as the mountains getting across the Rockies, they still had 15,000 pounds of equipment that they had to haul over the Rockies. You're talking about kettles. You're talking about trade goods, clothing, uniforms, as I say, weaponry, all the tents, all that kind of stuff that you needed to go.
And how many men were in on this expedition?
There's a little bit of controversy about this, because when they leave St. Louis, there's about 50 or so men that go up to Fort Mandan, which is in North Dakota. But from there west, from the middle of North Dakota out to the Pacific and back, there were 31 men and a baby and a woman. A baby and a woman, yes, Sacagawea. Yeah.
Wow. You've mentioned both Pittsburgh and mm-hmm. St. Louis, so mm-hmm. give us an idea of why those two cities are important.
Well, one of the debates amongst Lewis and Clark scholars is, where did the expedition begin? And so, does it begin in St. Louis? Does it begin at Fort Mandan? Does it begin at Pittsburgh? And I think it began in the mind of Thomas Jefferson, which puts us in Washington, D.C., because he's the president at that point. So Meriwether Lewis starts in Washington, goes to Philadelphia, meets with all the great scientists at that time, goes to Harper's Ferry in West Virginia to pick up all the equipment that needs, has that shipped to Pittsburgh. And then at Pittsburgh, they drop this very large keelboat, which was the size of a tractor trailer, into the water, load all this equipment on it, and then make their way down the Ohio. And then they meet Clark at Louisville, Kentucky, and then or Clarksville, Indiana, and then come on down from there as a team. And so they, it really depends on where you want to think of where it started. But as I say, even historians don't agree, because Lewis, while they're in St. Louis, is still the president's personal secretary. So he is still conducting political business for the president. And so he doesn't even leave St. Louis with the boats and the men. It's a few miles upstream before he finally jumps on the boat. And so that's why people say, well, it didn't even start at St. Louis. It was at St. Charles. So it's right. That's what good historians do. They argue about everything.
Meriwether Lewis was President?
President Jefferson's personal secretary. The families had known each other for many years, and he had come to Washington with Jefferson when he became president. They're both from Virginia.
Do we know why Jefferson would have chosen him to go on this rather dangerous, potentially?
Yes. For one thing, Lewis had been in the military. He had been on the Indian frontier, as had Clark before this in the 1790s. And in fact, Clark and Lewis had served together, Lewis serving underneath Clark, actually. He picked Lewis for his personal secretary because when he came into office, he was trying to get a listing, a view of all the officers in the American Army at that time, and trying to find who was loyal to the president, who wouldn't be loyal to the president. And then once he got there to Washington, he also began to plan for this expedition. So, and then, of course, pretty soon after that, Spain and France swapped land, and then we buy the land, of course, and the Louisiana Purchase, and it's on from there.
Right, so. And that the date on that is 1803.
Yes, that's right.
So that's right at the very same year that this expedition began.
They have already started the expedition at that point, and when they get to St. Louis, the final treaty is done, And in fact, the flags are switched there at St. Louis, and Meriwether Lewis is there to see that happen. Yeah.
We are chatting with Peter Osborne this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and our topic is the Lewis and Clark Expedition. I understand that from the talk that you gave the other day that Lewis and Clark themselves were very different kinds of men.
They were, and I think that when I went on this journey, one of the things I was interested in was the relationship between the two of them. To go back a little ways, Lewis had actually served underneath Clark on the frontier. William Clark is this very steady surveyor, boatman. He's not as prominent as the Lewis is. Lewis suffers from depression and had long before the expedition as well. Lewis is the more, I would say, he's inspiring the men by his character, but also by his personality, very charismatic. He's also the president's personal secretary, which is something. William Clark is brother to George Rogers Clark, very famous American hero from the American Revolution, and in the years after that. But they are very different kinds of people, and yet they seamlessly work together. And I guess there are several ways to look at this, but one of them is when Lewis invites Clark to be in this. He says, there's nobody else I'd rather do this with than you, and I really hope that you'll do this. And Clark writes back to Lewis and says, I would be just as thrilled to do this with you, and that's a paraphrase. Once they get going, once Lewis gets to Clarksville, which is where William Clark is then living, he has a letter from the Department of War that essentially made Clark the second lieutenant and Meriwether Lewis the captain. And Lewis had promised Clark co-captaincy. And so that was never said to the men. They both kept calling themselves and each other captain. And the men never knew of that rank differential in the whole time of the expedition. And then when they got back in 1806, there was, you know, a certificate there announcing that Clark was a captain. And I guess he just, you know, said, well, it doesn't really matter now. But they were great friends and partners, and really they're the kind of people that would have had each other's back, so to speak. They went through some really, really tough experiences together. And were became great friends. They had been friends before that, but I think the relationship became even stronger during the expedition.
How much a difference in age between the
two? Just a couple of years. They're not that much. Yeah, Clark is older, and Clark will also live much longer too than Meriwether Lewis did. So,
and how old were they when they went on this expedition?
They were in their early thirties. Yeah, and Lewis was a little bit younger than that. Lewis celebrated his 30th birthday out in Montana in 1805, but Clark was a couple of years older than them. But they were both suited. They somehow, you would think that they were so opposite, but in the end they turned out to be very suited to one another. So,
Peter Osborne, how old were you when you made this expedition?
let's see, that's 4 years ago, 5 years ago. So I was 51. Yeah,
so you're quite a bit older than
a little bit. Yeah, I never Lewis and I Clark. And I also did not do it by canoe or kayak or bow. I did it in an RV.
Right. Okay. Seamus is telling me that it's time for a break. So let's go for that, and we will be back speaking with Peter Osborne in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Tobacco-Free Northeast PA. May 31st was World No Tobacco Day, but it is not too late to make today your day to quit tobacco for good. They can help with professional counseling and ongoing support. For further information, 1-800-QUIT-NOW or tobaccofreene.com.
This is music that was popular and out there during the Lewis and Clark expedition. And that is our topic this evening with author and historian Peter Osborne, who lives right here in the Lehigh Valley.
Live in Easton, yep.
A local from Easton. Seamus, you're from where?
I'm originally from Coopersburg.
But right now, living?
I live in Bethlehem now.
Oh, you made a long journey, didn't you? Not as long as Lewis and Clark.
No, not quite as long.
And not as perilous, shall we say.
That's for sure.
We're going to invite our listeners to call in if you have comments or questions about our topic this evening, Lewis and Clark Expedition. Our number to call is 610-758-8810. Well, Peter Osborne, when you made your expedition, you wanted to follow the trail as much as you could mm-hmm. that Lewis and Clark had traveled. Did you start in Pittsburgh? Did you start in St. Louis? Or what exactly was
I actually started in Port Jervis, went to Washington, D.C., and went to the Jefferson Memorial and started. Actually, that was, if you wanted to ask me when the official, that was it, standing there at the Jefferson Memorial. And then from there, went to Harper's Ferry, went to Pittsburgh, and followed their route from there. So, because Meriwether Lewis, until he got to Indiana, was on his own, and then he picked up Clark there. And then from there, they were together. But that was my plan. And I was trying to follow. Lewis went through these very convoluted ways to get to Pittsburgh, because he had to come back to Philadelphia, then he had to go to Harper's Ferry. And it wasn't like today when there's this easy road to travel. You were having to really, that was a tough, even a journey for him, someone who was as well traveled as he was in the backcountry. It was still a tough journey for him to make. And then from there, they were on the keel. From that point on, they were mainly on water west from there.
Was President Jefferson instrumental in having this expedition take place?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thomas Jefferson is kind of a fascinating fellow in this for a couple reasons. One is that if you go to Monticello, the nice side of his house, the more beautiful side of his house, faces westward. It's not when you come in the front. It's actually when you go out the back door. Thomas Jefferson was a man who always looked to the west, even though, curiously, his career always looked to the east, towards Washington, towards France, towards New York and Philadelphia. But his spirit and his dream sense side of him always looked to the west. And so he was one that sent out during his administration 4 expeditions. This was not the only one. 2 of them involved Zebulon Pike, for whom Pike's Peak is named in Colorado. And then there was a 3rd expedition. And none of them were as successful as this expedition was. Zebulon Pike's was done around the same time as this. He goes to find the source of the Missouri River and has a catastrophic trip. Guys come back starving. And then he's almost as soon as he gets back, he's sent on to go out to find the headwaters of the Arkansas and the Red River. And he's captured by the Spanish in Colorado. Then there was this other fellow who tried to find the headwaters of the Red River as well, and he was successful, but none of those 3 trips were as successful as the Lewis and Clark expedition. And I think it's because Jefferson had more of a personal interest in it, and he also worked with Meriwether Lewis for a year or two before getting ready to do this. And Zebulon Pike's expeditions were not as well prepared for. And they both of them wound up with major problems. But the Lewis and Clark expedition, by any measure, was a great success. So,
I wonder if President Jefferson had not been president and have all that he had on his shoulders as chief of the country, if he might have gone on an expedition such as this. But you make it sound as if he really wanted to get over those mountains and go westward.
I think he had a very large collection of books in his library, many of which looked to the west. Mackenzie had just gone across the Canadian Rockies, which were not as large as the American Rockies were and as difficult to get across. And so he and Lewis, when that book was published in 1801 or 2, read that book. And both he and Lewis studied this closely, because this is what they anticipated would be when they got to the American Rockies, which was not the case. But he was very well versed in the West. There were a lot of questions. For example, he believed that there were Welsh, descendants of the Welsh had intermingled with the native peoples in the West. And there was even some thought that there might be mastodons left out in the Midwest as well. So in the West, this was an area that had never been traveled through by people from the United States. Of course, Native peoples had been there for 15,000 years, but the Army, this is the first military expedition across the country there. So this was new for a lot of reasons.
Lewis and Clark Expedition is our topic on Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening, and we're speaking with Peter Osborne, a local author and historian. When you made your trek westward, what were your goals?
I had a few. One was obviously to grieve Janice's passing, and I'd finished a memoir that I had written about her on this trip. Then after that, it was to follow this trail of Lewis and Clark. As best you could. I mean, in an RV along the Missouri, it's not always easy to do that because the rivers and the roads don't always parallel each other. That was one goal. Another goal, I was really very, very interested in this relationship between Lewis and Clark and what they had experienced, what their friendship was. Were there any moments that they just said, you know, I don't want to be with you anymore? And then another particular interest to me, because I was a historian, was the notion of seeing how the Lewis and Clark expedition is interpreted today. And there is a lot of material out there in the country related to the Lewis and Clark expedition, and a lot of new interpretive materials, visitor centers, signage, tour guides. There was and that was one of the major things I was looking for, because I was kind of curious what people thought about it today. And of course, the bicentennial of the expedition had only happened a few years before that, from 2003 to 6. So there were, every state chose a way to remember the expedition, and each of them built a visitor center that focused on some aspect of the expedition. So Nebraska focused on the plant life. Great Falls focused on the incredible difficult situation of getting past the portage past the falls. Out in Washington, Oregon, it was that time at Fort Clatsop and how they dealt with the Indians out there. But that was an interesting part of it. And then the last goal that I had, which really wasn't relevant to Lewis and Clark, but I was a great fan of Willa Cather. And so on the way back, I spent a week in what is known as Catherland, which is in Red Cloud, Nebraska.
So you had several goals as you made your trip out west. What was the most interesting thing? Is there anything you can pick out of your trip that you would call the most interesting or perhaps the most surprising?
Well, I would say the most interesting thing that I did was I brought their journals with me. So, and there are a fair number of places where you can stand almost on exactly the same spot and read a journal, and you know you're looking at what they're looking at. There's not many places, but there's enough places. So, for example, at Great Falls in Montana, you can stand on the exact same little slip of land that Lewis was on, and you can read, and I did, read his journal entry. And, of course, there's dams now on the Great Falls, but you can imagine certainly what it would have been like. You can imagine, certainly, they complained constantly in the journals about mosquitoes. And so at the junction of the Yellowstone and the Missouri, the mosquitoes are horrendous there. I got bitten. I was outside for 5 minutes and they just swarmed me. So, and these guys don't have an RV to go into. They've got to deal with these zillions and millions of bugs. But I would say that was probably the most interesting thing, because you're reading Lewis or Clark's or someone else's journal, and you're seeing, in many cases, exactly what they saw. Sometimes that's long gone now. I mean, the things have changed. The river channels have changed, or the height of the river. The rivers are now all configured, so there's dams and levees on them. But in many places, you could actually stand on that spot and say, gosh, this is exactly what they saw.
So, give us a sense of a description that they would give for a certain spot, and you knew that you were on that spot. How could it be so specific?
Well, the one at Great Falls is one of the most widely quoted ones. And the reason that is Lewis writes about the fact that this was such a beautiful place. The water, the spray of the water over the falls went a mile high. They could hear it from miles away, the falls. When you stand there, you can see why he was so impressed with the beauty of the place. And that night, he catches a couple trout. They have some flour with them. They do all these great. He has a great dinner, but then the next day he gets up and realizes that now the falls are there, and they can't obviously take rafts or canoes. And boats upstream. They're going to have to portage those boats around many miles around the falls. And so you get the moment you have of this is a beautiful place, but then you have the moment of like, oh no, now what? And then the one set of journal entries that most, I keep reading them over and over because they're so interesting. And this is when they go through the Rocky Mountains at the Lolo Pass, which was probably the worst moment of the expedition. And they understand that on the plains and getting into the Rockies, they're eating the equivalent of 32 quarter pounders a day. So that just to give you a sense. Now, all of a sudden, they're in the Rockies, 3 foot of snow. This is now September of 1804. Or five, and they are now eating soup. And there's no wildlife up in the mountains at that time of the year. And you read these amazing entries of not only the captains, but also the enlisted men. And while I realize it was a military expedition, you have to think that somebody would have said, you know what, we got to go back. This is craziness. Because they had no idea how far they still had to go yet. They weren't sure how far the Rockies were, five ranges to the Rocky Mountains. And so that entry, and I was on the Lolo Pass in the spot where they were, and I was there in August, so it wasn't, you know, it didn't have 3 foot of snow in it then yet. But I have to say that you can't help but walk away and be impressed by what they had written. But I would say the reading of those journals at those places, and the other one was at the Lemhi Pass, where Lewis happened just to turn 30 years old on that day. And he writes about how this is the man, the personal secretary of the president of the United States, who is in the middle of this incredible journey leading these men across the country. And he writes something like, I haven't done anything with my life yet. I got to really get home and do something when I get home. That's a paraphrase. But I mean, it's just an amazing thing, given what he was doing at that very moment in his life. So.
Right. Which has turned out to be one of the great expeditions, perhaps the greatest.
Probably greatest American
of the U.S.
expedition.
History.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. Yep.
The Lewis and Clark Expedition, 1803 to 1806. I keep repeating that because timelines are important for me, and I'm sure they are to you as
Absolutely.
A historian,
sure.
too. You mentioned the journals. Give us a sense of how many pages total. Mm-hmm. Are there many of them or a couple of them?
There are about 8,000 pages. Every man was required to keep a journal on the expedition. Only a few of them have come down. Lewis's and Clark's have. Patrick Gass's came down. A couple of the other fellows, parts of them, came down. Patrick Gass, about a year after the expedition was over with, published his journals. But the editor had kind of not taken his daily entries. He'd kind of paraphrased it. So it was not the actual journal entries. Lewis and Clark, Lewis died so quickly after the expedition, and he was tasked with that job. Clark did not want to do the journals. He didn't want to see them published. And it was really Lewis's job to do that. He dies in 1809, and so they now take a few more years before they're done. And by that point, unfortunately for the expedition's historical sense, America was in another war of 1812, and so the interest in the expedition had dissipated by that point. However, they were published, again, paraphrases, not the actual notes themselves. And it was not until the last part of the 19th century that a person did have them transcribed and had them typed and typeset and then published. There were only a very few number of those copies available. Theodore Roosevelt had one of them. And so it wasn't until the 1950s that the first abridged version of the journals became available by Bernard DeVoto. In more recent years, in the last 20 years, Gary Moulton has done another abridged version of them. And so there are two versions of those journals that you can now read. They are all online at the University of Nebraska, and the University of Nebraska has all 8,000 pages, which are annotated, which have all the descriptions of where people are, what they're doing at what point, where they are physically on the ground. But the journals are one of the great masterpieces of American literature. And Clark kept his journal every day. There's no doubt about that. Lewis had months where he did not keep his. And there's been a lot of speculation. Perhaps they were lost. Some have speculated he was so depressed that he couldn't write. Because he did suffer from depression, but no one is quite sure. And, you know, I think every Lewis and Clark historian would love to see those at some point. And they're still finding things. William Clark's part of his journals did not come forward until the 1950s, were found in one of his descendants' attics. So it's not inconceivable that Lewis's books still might be out there. They could have been lost. There's so many different possibilities, except that, you know, they were very careful. They were writing these, they were taking notes during the day on paper, and then at night, or when they had a chance, they would transcribe these into these beautiful leather-bound books, and then they would seal them in a tin case. And when they returned, and this is, I mean, they flipped out of boats at least once. They were almost lost. Sacagawea saved them. When they got back, Lewis carried them with him personally everywhere. And finally, they wound up at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, which is where they are today, all the tin cases with the books in them.
Can the public see those, or does one have to have special permission, be an historian?
I haven't gone there yet because I keep wanting to go and see one. I have seen a reprint of them, a color reprint of them, that was published during the bicentennial. But I think they were on display for the bicentennial, but I do not believe that they're on display now.
This is Peter Osborne, local author and historian, talking about the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Our number to call if you'd like to join in and ask a question or give a comment is 610-758-8810.
You know, I can give you the email address or the web page for the journal because it's really fascinating. But the address for this is www.lewisandclarkjournals.com. .unl.edu. So that's the address that you can go to. Or you just Google Lewis and Clark Journals. So.
And UNL is University?
University of Nebraska Library.
Of Nebraska Library. UNL.
And that's also an interesting story because there was a very large grant that was going to be given to have these put online, transcribed and put online. And you would have thought that the University of Montana, for example, would have been, because they spent more time there than anywhere, would have taken that opportunity, did not. And so the University of Nebraska did. Gary Moulton became their editor, and so they're all there now online. And you can go through thousands of pages of them. Every day's entries are there. And they've also placed them so that Lewis's, Clark's, if Patrick Gass's, or whoever else has written on that day, so that you get the view of what everybody was writing on that day.
The Lewis and Clark Expedition, did they have any maps at all when they set out from the east to go westward?
They only knew two things in terms of mapping and surveying. They knew what the latitude and longitude was of the meeting of the Missouri and the Mississippi River, and they knew what the latitude and longitude was of the Columbia River at the Pacific. That was it. Everything else in between was pretty much a blank space. And because Clark was a surveyor, every day he's taking bearings and readings. And in fact, when you read the online version, you'll just see pages and pages of these bearings. But he is mapping the whole way out. And while they sit at Fort Clatsop in Oregon during the course of that winter of 1805-6, he draws the map, what became known as the Clark map, and brings that home. And that was the map of the West for almost 30 years after the expedition. And I've read different things about the accuracy of the maps, but I have heard in some cases that they're accurate within 70 miles. Now, when you consider they were traveling thousands of miles, that's pretty good. But the map was the first map ever done on the West. And this is before GPS. This is before, you know, their equipment is getting banged around, beaten up. And it's pretty remarkable that the map is accurate. I mean, except that there are many more oxbows now, or there were then in the Missouri. Now it's more of a straight river than it was in those days. But the accuracy is pretty remarkable, and they're also physically beautiful to look at. And there are books of his maps that have been printed, and they're just a work of art to look at. And he was a very good surveyor, and that was one of the skills that he was brought on the trip to do.
Exactly. Sounds perfect. It's time to take a break now, so stay with us, and we'll have more about the Lewis and Clark Expedition coming up in 60 seconds.
For program support on WDIY, we thank ArtsQuest and the Music Fest Cafe presented by Yuengling, located at the ArtsQuest Center Steel Stacks in Bethlehem. with performances by Keller Williams Thursday, June 13th, Tig Notaro Friday, June 14th, John McLaughlin and the Fourth Dimension Monday, June 17th, and the David Murray Infinity Quartet featuring Macy Gray Tuesday, June 18th. For tickets, artsquest.org or 610-332-3378.
Yankee Doodle went to town riding on a pony. Stuck a feather in his cap and called it macaroni.
Yankee Doodle, keep it up. Yankee Doodle, dandy. Mind the music and the step and with the girls be handy.
Seamus, is that your combo there with you singing lead?
No, that was not me.
He's disavowing right away on the air.
I'm considerably worse.
All right. Well, we appreciate Peter Osborne bringing in the music for us today. It really gets us in the mood to talk about Lewis and Clark and their expedition. So, Peter, what was your favorite sight on the trip?
I actually had three. The first was the Lemhi Pass. This is a spot where the Missouri River actually ends, or at least they thought that in 1804.
In which state?
This is in Montana, right on the Continental Divide, right on the Idaho-Montana border. And when you stand up on the ridge there on the Continental Divide, you're looking, if in a 360-degree turn, it's just mountains. And you have to understand, they're here now in August, late August. They are worried about two things. One is they have to get horses from the Shoshone Indians to get over the Rockies, because now they're at the end of the Missouri River. They are in August. They know they can see snow-capped mountains off to the west, and they have yet to see a Shoshone Indian yet at the Lemhi Pass. And so they are worried about that. But it is one of those spots. It was one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to. And what happens is you come up the Missouri River, and having now traveled it for a couple thousand miles, all of a sudden you're there, and there's just this little bit of water that comes out of the side of the mountain. And one of Lewis's men that was with him, they had broken the party up at that point, one of Lewis's men stands on both sides of the Missouri there and says something like, "I never thought I would be able to stand over the Missouri River." So that was my first favorite place. The second was the Lolo Pass, which I described before, but you can still walk that path today. This is the same path that they did, and it's called National Historic Trail. It's called the Nez Perce Nee Mi Pu National Historic Trail. And when you walk on that trail, you're walking on a trail not only that's 15,000 years old, but is also a trail that they walked on, and it's very remote. It's when you're there, you just feel like you're in the middle of nowhere, and I can't imagine what it would have been like with 3 foot of snow out there, no food, just what they called portable soup, which was a mixture of dried vegetables and fat and boiled in water. That's all that they have to eat, and you're trying to push and pull and get your equipment through all that snow. And I guess the last place was also a special place. I mentioned Bernard DeVoto. There is a Bernard DeVoto Grove. This is on the Idaho side of the Lolo Mountains there. And as I mentioned, Bernard DeVoto was the first one to create an abridged version of the journals. But what's very unique about that particular location is that he camped there with the Coots version. This is the late 19th century version, and transcribed them and abridged them. And he had a canvas tent. He stayed out there every summer. He was a teacher back east here. And after the books were published in the 50s, but after he died, his family scattered his ashes at that grove, and it's been named that for him ever since.
And that's in which state?
That's in Idaho, just on the other side of Route 12, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So some of the highlights of your trip that you made following the trail of the explorers, Lewis and Clark. Are some of the trails that, if any of us wanted to duplicate what you have done, are some of the trails visible today?
That Nez Perce Trail is. And of course, you can follow the Missouri River, although it's changed courses in many places. But there are more and more places that we know where they were And I say that because it's only until recently, until the last 15 years, there was only one place on the entire length of the route that they had traveled that there was a piece of evidence left from them. And that was called Pompey's Pillar, as it's called now, or Pompey's Tower. And that was a place where William Clark, on the return trip in 1806, had carved his name into a rock wall. And it's still there to this day. It was discovered in the 1860s by a railroad crew. But in the last decade, they have found two of their campsites. One is at Traveler's Rest, which is west of Missoula, Montana. And then one is at the Dalles, which is on the Columbia River. The one at the Traveler's Rest was interesting because I met the person who was in charge of the excavations. And what had happened is local historians for decades had thought that they had camped at a certain spot based on the records, based on what they where the stream had gone that was there. And more scholars, other newer scholars came in and said, you know, we don't think it's there. We think it's about a mile away. And they came in, and this was a military expedition, so they had to follow military rules when they were laying out a campsite. There was a standard procedure. And so they began to look at this open field next to a former stream bed and saw the depression, a depression, where the latrine probably was, and then saw the depressions where the campfires had been, and began to do archaeological work there. And there they found the first Lewis and Clark campsite for sure. And the reason that they knew it was they, as they were digging out the fireplaces, they found molten lead. And that was lead left over from them casting musket balls. And not only did they find that, but they traced it back to the mine, the lead mine in the east where it had come from, and it matched it exactly. So they found that, I think, a couple buttons, a coat buttons there. But that was the first site. And then they found, and they were digging this when I was there on my trip, at the Dalles, which is a town on the Columbia River. And they had kind of narrowed down a spot that they were doing a lot of excavations at now. One of the things about that, those three things, is that the technology that has being brought into this now is pretty remarkable. And, you know, now there's GPS, there's all these satellite photos, these professional archaeologists, historians are all working together, and they're finding lots more information now. And because of all these journals being online and accessible, it's great for people who are doing research on it. So, and I'm sure they're going to find more campsites because there were hundreds and hundreds of campsites during the course of those trips. The trip in and trip out, and I'm sure that more technology will come to bear. For another example is they were able to, the Lewis had a dog, Newfoundland, a dog, that everybody thought was called Scannon, S-C-A-N-N-O-N. And for 100 years, that's what people thought. Well, they began to analyze that handwriting of Meriwether Lewis's, and what they actually found was that it was Seaman, not Scannon. And so that happened relatively recently. And so that's the kind of research that's been brought to bear on this. And it's happening particularly from St. Louis West, but there's even an Eastern legacy, which goes from Pittsburgh to St. Louis. And while they passed very quickly through on the Ohio River, they still did come down the Ohio. They still camped at places at night. And so there's still a bit of that. And the Philadelphia legacy is particularly important in Harper's Ferry. But at least there are these bits, this new technology, the new research, and new abilities to see things that couldn't be seen before.
Well, Seamus, we hear about the Lewis and Clark expedition and maybe even study it a little bit as school children. I always thought, I just forgot what they taught me, but when I hear Lewis and Clark, I'm thinking of two men
right.
going out there looking like Daniel Boone. In a covered wagon.
Well,
and
those are the pictures. Those are the pictures that you see in the school books and everything. It's them over a map looking out at the landscape, but there was actually more than just the two of them.
Every time they met with Native peoples, everybody would dress in their Class A uniforms and to put on a show and to have their weaponry out. And then they would turn into their civvy clothes during the day. And then once they got west of Fort Mandan, they were wearing elk skin or deer or buffalo, and were wearing more natural kinds of clothing. But they kept their uniforms all the way through, and of course they got pretty worn out too. But Lewis and Clark both had their uniforms all the way from beginning to end. Although Clark, I think, traded one of his jackets at one point for something, but. It was a military expedition, and there were punishments if you did things wrong, although that happened mainly before they left Fort Mandan. But when they were in St. Louis, across from St. Louis, there were some incidents where the men had to be disciplined. So, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Lewis and Clark Expedition. Did anybody on this expedition die?
Yes, only one person. That is one of the expedition. There was Sergeant Floyd, and just at the junction of where South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa meet, he suffered from appendicitis. And at that time, there was no cure for appendicitis. Even if they had been in Philadelphia, he would not have been cured of that. So he died there. They buried him there, and with full military ceremony. It's the first military burial of the United States west of the Mississippi River. And then very soon after that, a few days later, a new sergeant, he was a sergeant, was picked. Charles Floyd was his name. He's buried there. The expedition presses on, comes back, and when they come back, they see that his grave has been ransacked. And so he's reburied there. And then they come back, of course, to St. Louis. And in the decades after that, it was on a bank of the Missouri, and so the bank erodes away, and he was disinterred again, I suppose. They finally moved him back farther and built this huge obelisk on top of him, so he's now resting in peace, but it was a long time before he did. He was the only person on the expedition to die. There were many people that were injured during the course of this. And two Native Americans were killed in Montana, northern Montana, two Blackfoot Indians. When the expedition was returning, they split it in half, which everyone, I think, most historians of the expedition agree was a terrible mistake. But Meriwether Lewis took the northern route back to do more exploring, to create a claim that the United States actually extended farther north than what it did. And in that case, they slept one night with some Blackfeet Indians, and the Blackfeets tried to steal their guns. And Lewis ordered them to drop the guns. They didn't, and two of them were killed. The other ones got away, left, I should say. And the Lewis and the men that were with him rode at an incredibly fast pace to get away because they knew that they would be in trouble. There was only a handful of them. In one of these weird circumstances, it didn't resolve itself until years later, but George Drilliard, who was one of the main scouts, one of the most important people, aside from Lewis and Clark, he was probably the most important person on the expedition. He returned to Blackfoot country in a decade after the expedition, and Blackfeet recognized him, and he was killed. But those were the only two Native Americans. By and large, the Native peoples were very, very welcoming and very helpful to the
expedition. So that was the only skirmish between the Natives and the expedition. Did the expedition make it all the way to the Pacific Ocean?
Yes, it did. It got out to the Columbia and came down the Columbia out to the Pacific. And then there was a debate there as to whether to come back up the Columbia in winter, because now it was late fall. It was December of 1805, or to stay on either the Oregon side or the Washington side. And in one of these great moments of American history, it's called the Independence Hall of the West. Everybody on the expedition was asked to vote as to where they should spend the winter. The captains did not make the decision unilaterally. They listened to everybody. And so some wanted to go back up the Columbia where the weather would be more temperate. Some wanted to stay on the coast because there was hope that if a British or an American ship came by, they could just get on a ship and go home and not have to go back overland. And they were prepared. They had a blank check from Thomas Jefferson to do that. And in the end, they decided to camp or to stay at Fort Clatsop, which is on the Oregon side of the river, which is by the ocean, and decided to stay there for the winter and never did see a ship. So then the next spring they had to turn around and come back overland again. So
and then they split and went north-south.
That's right. When they got east of the Rockies, they split. Meriwether Lewis with a small group of men went to the north, which would be up towards Great Falls, up in the Marias River up that way. Lewis or Clark comes back and gets onto the Yellowstone River and follows that all the way to its juncture with the Missouri River in very far eastern Montana.
Did they meet up back east?
They met up at that junction of that river. It's amazing that it happened, but they both agreed to meet at a certain day at that juncture of those rivers, and they did within a day or two of each other. It was pretty remarkable that
happened.
And
that was in what state?
It was right on the border between Montana and North Dakota, yeah. And so they had come all the way across Montana within a couple days of each other to get to that spot and had not quite on the same day, but got there pretty closely, so.
I think it certainly speaks to their talents as explorers, certainly, to be able to do something like that.
And leadership, because without two great leaders like Lewis and Clark, it just would not have happened. Twice during the expedition, they came to junctures and rivers, at the Marias River, for example, and at Three Forks in Montana, where no one could agree as to which river to go up, because now they're trying to get to the headwaters of the Missouri. And say you have a break in the river, which side do you go to? And so on each of those cases, they sent men up the rivers. Clark and Lewis both went up the rivers to look at the stone, how cold the water was, how fast the water was coming, to try to decide which branch of a river to take. And in both cases, the men voted unanimously to go a different route than Lewis and Clark did. And Lewis and Clark were right both times. They had the right river both times. So which says something. And, you know, here again, the men all said, okay. You know, that they were. I know that my military friends will say, well, as a military expedition, you have to listen to your captain. That's the way it is. But, you know, there was 30 of them or 29 of them. So
there could have been mutiny.
Yeah, huh? There could have been. It's happened before in American history, right. Sure.
We want to thank Peter Osborne for coming to Lehigh Valley Discourse here in eclectic South Bethlehem.
Yes.
Peter, thank you so much. Listeners, you can hear from this interview what an interesting speaker Peter is. And I want to give him a chance, though he did not ask for this, but to talk a little bit about a company that he has formed called PienPack, PienPack.
Mm-hmm.
You could look it up online.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
And it provides various services.
We do tours. We do now mainly we're, of course, writing books. But we also do, as you heard me speak, at the Siegel Museum over there in Easton. We do a lot of lectures, and we offer lectures on FDR, Theodore Roosevelt, this Lewis and Clark trip as well. And I have one on Willa Cather, of course. So I'm very interested in a lot of these topics. I've always liked to share the knowledge I have, so I have all these PowerPoint programs that we give regularly. So,
thank you so much again for coming.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Lehigh Valley Discourse. Seamus, thank you so much for your help this evening. And remember to be gentle with your neighbor.
This is WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM NHD, listener-supported community public radio. Up next, Celtic Fair with Rick Weaver.